Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
And from New Orleans, Louisiana, a special edition of Le Show, ladies and gentlemen, because it's Mardi Gras weekend.
What?
A lot of the regular features, plus a fascinating conversation with a man who's radically trying to reimagine the future of New Orleans. And no, it's not Mayor Ray Nagin. But first, let's go digital.
High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland.
First, some letters. Emails, actually.
Got to be so careful where you stand in the digital wonderland.
All right, Patty will be our yin. Patty writes, let me preface this with the fact that I live literally in the middle of nowhere in southeastern Ohio. No four-lane roads, no cell service, dial-up internet. I bought a converter box, hooked it up, and was able to receive digital TV on my 18-year-old set and antenna. But it was like watching in a snowstorm. Analog was clear as a bell. Yesterday, we installed a brand new HD TV. It was hooked directly to the antenna. We turned it on, and the digital picture is as perfect as the analog. This seems to prove that the TV makes a difference, as that is the only item that changed. It is sad that people in rural areas may have to go to the expense of a new TV to stay connected to the outside world. Perhaps instead of converter box coupons, the government should issue digital television coupons. Thanks, Patty. The yang comes from Hans, who writes, thanks a lot. Since the original date for the cessation of analog television broadcasts has been extended, my reception of digital broadcasts has deteriorated. Signals that were strong before the original deadline are now weaker, and the quality is poor with dropouts and poor signal strength. What is going on? I have two acquaintances who are news cameramen for local stations. They asked the engineers, since stations must still broadcast analog, they must broadcast on two frequencies, both analog and digital. They have reduced the wattage on their digital broadcast to save money, resulting in poor digital strength. Thanks a lot, Harry, you Luddite.
Okay.
The venerable VCR is one of the unsung casualties of the move to digital television. Consumers who've used the devices to record over-the-air or cable channels will soon be losing key features as both systems go from analog to digital. They will be left to choose from a few jerry-built or pricey solutions. Hi, I'm Jim at Pricey Solutions. There are workarounds. VCR owners could watch one program record another if they hooked up a second converter box to the same TV with the second box sending its signal directly to the TV instead of the VCR. It requires extra equipment and some wires, which ladies love. Swapping out an old VCR with a new one that has a digital tuner doesn't solve the problem of not being able to watch one program and record another. And digitally enabled VCRs typically won't tune in digital cable because you can't find one that will decode the scrambled signals. Of course, the federal government has told people that all you need is the converter boxes. What they're not telling people is you won't be able to record as you previously did. We don't have the perfect solution yet for VCR customers affected by the digital transitions, says Megan Pollack of the Consumer Electronics Association. But she expressed faith if consumers make an issue of these lost features, the manufacturers will respond. The marketplace will adapt, she said. That's a faith-based solution. That's the way the marketplace adapted when the insatiable demand for digital television originated in the first place. They went to the government. The digital transition has left some confused. A Joplin, Missouri man was frustrated with the switch, so frustrated that he peppered his television set with gunfire. The 70-year-old man was livid over losing cable and could not get his digital converter box to work. News of the digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen. And speaking of broadcasting, this just in, residents living in six United States cities are for the most part dissatisfied with local radio, says a survey from the Rochester Institute of Technology. Radio listeners indicated through survey answers that 4 out of every 10 in these markets rate the effectiveness of local radio as providing them with very little satisfaction or zero satisfaction in terms of local programming. Stand by for very little satisfaction, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, welcome to the show. This is LeShow, and another interview with another New Orleanian who is standing up and making a difference in the city. I became aware of his project and his passion. I guess it was in October when Tulane University had a public showing one Monday morning of the results of a weekend-long series of discussions and plans among American and Dutch planners, architects, and designers to reimagine the city's relationship with water. It turns out to be part of a project called Dutch Dialogues, and David Wagoner is in New Orleans to discuss it today. David, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for those who listened about New Orleans.
How did Dutch Dialogues come about? And what is it?
It's maybe a figment of my imagination at times, I think, Harry. Although there's continuing interest. It's really a collaboration with the Dutch government. The American Planning Association has supported this at their top levels, the executive director and the first assistant. But the Dutch government has been the key to this, and a lot of it has been my own advocacy that we think differently about where we live here. We think differently about water, including it instead of excluding it. In brief, it's a collaboration through the Dutch Embassy in Washington with the City of Rotterdam and to a lesser degree the City of Amsterdam, also the province of South Holland, Technical University at Delft, another, and the Hoogeschool in Rotterdam, and private firms, landscape architects, and the larger civil engineering concerns. It is pretty amazing that there is this level of interest in New Orleans. But I guess it's a beautiful old lady, even if she's a little broken down.
And you come at this from...
I'm an architect. Mm. We have done what I used to think was planning, but I now better understand as urban design. We'd done some of that in North Louisiana and done some of that in China. We were involved in the planning processes in New Orleans, bring New Orleans back, and then the Unified New Orleans Plan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, at the end of the Unified New Orleans Plan is where this chapter begins, which is November 06, having realized there was so little attention paid to infrastructure, with even less paid explicitly to water. Our safety, and certainly not the value of water, not enough paid, in my view at least, to economic development, which sounds like a coarse thing, but if you're in a city with a lot of poor people, I don't think that, you know, it's great to say, well, we're fine the way we are. I don't think it is fine the way we are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in November 06 is when I started going to the Dutch Embassy in Washington, and then in 07, January, started going to the Netherlands to involve this, what I call knowledge network, which is what the Dutch just call, you know, the Dutch, that they're all there working together to think about these things. You know, their prince is a studied water management. So this fairly unglamorous term to them is fundamental.
They've been at it for a while.
8 centuries at least. Mm. You know, they basically created their land. There's that cliche, that funny cliche about God creating the heavens and the earth, but the Dutch made Holland. And they made a lot of mistakes. They're quick to tell you that. They're very self-critical people. But being self-critical means you can be self-correcting. And over the years, they've learned from their own mistakes, and that knowledge is an exportable thing to them. But it's also something that because they're good Calvinists, they think they should share.
And you went to them under what auspices?
arrogance, false belief.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was raised in politics. My father was a congressman, and I didn't choose that course. I thought design could make a difference. Little did I know that it wouldn't overcome politics.
Mm.
So I guess I was sort of maybe bred to think I could do more than just be a regular citizen. But I also think, Harry, that the real story of New Orleans is about regular citizens. And, you know, our government has not been the most effective. And so we've, as members of the polis, stood up and done what we can do. The problem is we're overmatched. It's not possible for me, individual, with no real authority to stand not against but with or even with the Corps of Engineers. And, you know, we have this need now to represent ourselves, and that's what we're trying to use the experts to do.
So from 2006 to that morning at Tulane in October where these really remarkable plans were presented, which, to summarize what I saw that morning, were a call to reimagine the relationship of New Orleans to water, to stop fighting a war against water, and to start living with water to enhance both safety and the beauty of the city, and done at three different levels of detail, one a region-wide level, one a sort of a neighborhood level, and one a very granular block level of design. How did you come from that meeting in Holland to that morning in Tulane?
The trip to the Netherlands in 06, we spent a lot of time looking at the coastal defenses that were there. We went out to see the gates and the barriers and the large-scale public works.
Those are those beautiful gates that you see on the internet next to the photos of the crappy stuff in New Orleans, right?
Right. It's the envy, right, that Americans have for technology, you know. That was then, but you know, this effort's been more an internal, as you alluded to. You know, it's been more from the inside out. We have our problems in Louisiana with coastal restoration problems, wetlands, rising sea level, all this. Those are really problems that can't be ignored, have to be dealt with. Some people are trying very hard to deal with that. My perception was no one was really dealing with the internal urban issues that could improve safety, and as you said, the beauty of the city, the value of the city. So I started going, as I said, back in January of 07, went again in end of March, 1st of April with the head of the American Planning Association. We've been seeking funding all along because this is generally paid for by my friends who probably want to avoid me because I ask them for $5,000 or $10,000 at a time sometimes, my firm, and as I say, the Dutch government. But we thought we had funding a couple times and haven't. Maybe that's allowed the reality that we've engaged to be selective enough to be attractive. Because sometimes if you just go in to solve the narrow problem and here's your client, maybe you can't think broadly. And especially when engineering disciplines are involved, you have to think more broadly. The first Dutch dialogue was really a presentation mostly of the way the Dutch deal with water in their own place. What are techniques that the Dutch use in the Netherlands that they, the people we invited, might think would be applicable here? It was not looking specifically at this terrain. So you know, we had a Dutch Dialogues 1. The one you saw was Dutch Dialogues 2, which was a Friday through Monday presentation. We presented Monday morning, as you saw, the results of working at these three scales. We now have some people who are interested in going forward with this, including those of you who would listen about it. And, you know, we have an administration that probably has to engage infrastructure just to get us out of the economic morass we've fallen into. And, you know, maybe this is timely.
Yeah, except that we're not shovel ready in their cliche of the moment, are we?
We are not. We are not. And I've known that for quite a while, Harry, which is why the intensity of the thing grows, which is why it wakes me up at night. New Orleans can't ask everybody to rebuild it the way it was. I don't think a city with the repetitive loss ratio we had is okay the way it was. I don't think, you know, that we can ignore the subsidence that we have. So I think, you know, you have to think differently. I think any political system, you know, any engineering system is like a natural system. It has to self-correct to endure. And I think that part of the self-correction here, I mean, I think my focus is on the water. What do we do with the groundwater? What do we do with the surface water? And how do we make that the lyrical basis of our city, but also the functional basis of our engineering system?
More with David moments from now here on the show, but first.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
The General Accountability Office, the Government Accountability Office, actually, reports that tens of thousands of assault rifles and other firearms in Afghanistan are at risk of being stolen because U.S. officials have lost track of them. Gee, that doesn't sound familiar, does it? No reliable records show what ultimately happened to 135,000 weapons donated by NATO countries. Many of the weapons supplied between 2004 and 2008 were left in the care of Afghan-run military depots with a history of desertion, theft, and subpar security systems that sometimes consist of a wooden door and a padlock. Meanwhile, in the war on terror, an international group of judges and lawyers has warned that systemic torture and other abuses in the global war on terror have undermined cherished values of civil rights in the United States, Britain, and other countries. We have been shocked by the damage done over the past 7 years by excessive or abusive counterterrorism measures, says Arthur Chaskelson, a member of the International Commission of Jurists. Many governments, ignoring the lessons of history, have allowed themselves to be rushed into hasty responses to terrorism that have undermined cherished values and violated human rights. Chaskelson is a former Chief Justice of South Africa. He should know. The worst of the worst, ladies and gentlemen, the Chinese Uyghurs, they are people who advocate for a separatist regime for their racial minority, their ethnic minority in China. Therefore, they've been languishing in Guantanamo for 7 years, maybe because we were trying to please the Chinese government. A court last October, federal court ruled they must be released into the United States. This week, a U.S. appeals court reversed that ruling, saying the court doesn't have the power to regulate immigration. So the 17 Uyghurs, never convicted or even accused of anything remotely against the United States, remain in Guantanamo. The worst of the worst. And the U.S. will have to keep about 60,000 troops in Afghanistan for at least the next 3 to 4 years. U.S. commander in Afghanistan says that. He warns this will be a tough year. So drink up. Back to our conversation with David Wagoner.
David, at any point during these dialogues, has there been any representation from the people who, as I understand it, up to now and still going forward, control New Orleans' relationship with water, i.e. the Army Corps of Engineers?
We've had conversations with them, Harry. I think that they're not the enemy. Their problem definition is maybe what some of us question. I'm an architect. You know, we typically try to define the problem broadly so that over time the facility we're designing, the site, the condition works. The Corps model, you know, to date has been that this is what we're asked to do. This is what Congress, with their 535 chief executives, have told them to solve. And so they go about solving that individual problem, with maybe that problem creating another problem or having a downside for the adjacent water body or the adjacent residence or land situation. So have they been involved? Not much. Do they know about this? Yes, they know about this. There are people I've met with since October, and they're not uninterested. Their view is it's not their charge.
So your charge would be, how do you make it their charge?
I think that's what people are telling me here. I think I think that the need is, you know, and I think even the Corps, at least at some level, would be happy if they were given another broader mandate. The coastal protection, hurricane levees, and all those things are their clear charge. They have to keep the water out of New Orleans. But we, in the thesis of this whole thing, is you don't just try to keep the water out. You actually create space in the city that can receive some of the water. And you know, the great example, the easy one, I think we showed at the October workshop, is if you go and you build a barrier at the outfall, at the edge of the outfall canals. And those who aren't from New Orleans, we have several outfall canals. As the city expanded outwards, we drained the swamp and we pushed the water through these canals to a lake. And, you know, we didn't set it up right. You wouldn't normally put the pump inside. You'd put it at the outside and you would draw the water, keeping it low, and then pump it out to the where you want it to go. But that's not the history of urbanization in New Orleans. For the last 100 years, we've been draining and pushing it out. So what it requires is that the water level, as I understand it, be set fairly high and be pumped out. Once the Corps builds these barriers at the lake, which we have temporary examples of now, then the water levels are different. But their charge is not only to have given us the interim protection, but by some date that may be 2011, I don't know that number exactly, Harry, they have to put the permanent pump stations in place. Well, they don't have the charge to deal with the outfall canals. Their responsibility ends at the lake to keep the water out. But there's an obvious interrelation between the canal, the level of the canal, and the barrier at the outside that now keeps the water from coming in. So it's not a storm problem anymore, but we're left with these collapsed, in some cases in the past, and pretty hideous eye walls, which means that the people who live next to these live next to a freeway wall. And we have no benefit. So what we're doing is, by going piecemeal through this situation, really not taking advantage of opportunity and probably wasting a lot of money, certainly creating no value.
Well, you know, David, I've been in and around New Orleans for 20 years now, and I would always drive across these places with these mysterious walls and have... Even as you're driving across them, unless you're looking very carefully, you really don't get a good view of what it is you're crossing. It wasn't until Katrina, until the flooding, the breaches at all those places, where I realized, oh, I see. I was driving across the 17th Street Canal. I was driving across the Lennon Avenue. They are the point that was one of the points that was made during your presentation was people. The way that this stuff has been designed and built really walled off the water in good times and bad from the city. And everybody who's ever lived in a city knows that if you view water, you are on a piece of property that's worth more than a piece of property that doesn't view water. So you guys seem to sort of make a connection between those two facts. What's been the response of city officials to these conversations?
Interest. You know, we have organizational problems, not just in New Orleans, but especially in New Orleans, Harry. You know, we have You know, we have the Sewerage and Water Board in New Orleans that's responsible for every pipe above 3 feet in diameter, I believe is the number, maybe 42 inches. We have the Department of Public Works that has the streets that are associated. You know, we have the utilities. We have the City Planning Commission. We have the Office of Community Development. We have this New Orleans Redevelopment Authority that has a lot of the vacant properties now. We have the Flood Protection Authority East that's supposed to maintain the levees that the Corps builds. We have CPRA that really has a coastal reference or response, but, you know, this is an interrelated ecosystem, so it has to relate. That's really a state agency. And, of course, we have the Corps of Engineers, Regional Planning Commission. How many more? We have this organizational problem. And one of the things that we've been trying to do is identify that problem. There's a hopefully there will be an effort by the state to convene these groups into a you know, the Dutch would call it an atelier, which I think is a kind of a delicate term. I think it's you know, put people in a room and let them begin to realize that they have these perhaps competing interests because they have different domains or territories, but that they have these interrelated charges that they need to, you know, be responsible for.
It sounds to me like you need maybe to convene another dialogue where the Dutch tell you how different bureaucracies work together, because obviously they have different bureaucracies that have been able to combine to get a more holistic approach, or have they?
They have. They had thousands of water boards at one point, and they're down to some, less than 100 now. The water board is all powerful there. You know, you don't develop anything without water being considered first. We talked about that. We had a new meeting, another meeting of the group in Rotterdam, and we talked about that. And, you know, apart from their counseling me to be patient, which doesn't sit too well, they said, you know, you need to solve this organizational problem or you can't eventually operate these systems. I mean, New Orleans is still protectable. It's a question of whether we can organize ourselves to protect ourselves.
That is a good question. We organize Mardi Gras. More with David Wagoner moments from now here on the show. But first, ladies and gentlemen, in the waning days of the Bush administration, Vice President Cheney launched a last-ditch campaign to persuade President Bush to pardon Scooter Libby and was furious when President Bush wouldn't budge. Sources close to Cheney told the New York Daily News the former vice president repeatedly pressed Bush to pardon Libby, arguing his longtime alter ego and ex-chief of staff deserved a full exoneration. He tried to make it happen right up to the very end, one Cheney associate said. In multiple conversations, in person and over the phone, Cheney tried to get Bush to change his mind. He went to the mat and came back and back and back at Bush, a Cheney defender said. He was still trying the day before Obama was sworn in. After repeatedly telling Cheney his mind was made up, Bush became so exasperated with Cheney's persistence, he told aides he didn't want to discuss the matter any further. That left Cheney bitter. He's furious with Bush, a Cheney source told the New York Daily News. He's really angry about it and decided he's going to say what he believes. More on this story a few inches below the surface of the earth.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who was just a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney.
Confidential.
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 Confidential. Wyoming is beautiful this time of year. The hunting, the fishing, the ability to live a secure, undisclosed lifestyle in a relatively public place because there's almost nobody there. Even so, life without the reins of maximum executive power backed by a Justice Department willing and able to dispense legitimacy on demand, it's been a grueling experience for Lynn and me. Especially Lynn. For one thing, civilian decorators just don't take orders in the same grimly cheerful way the Navy Seabees do. Also, the Secret Service guys, though they're still with us on the fishing trips, can no longer be commanded to catch the damn fish. A lesser man might be diminished by these new circumstances, but since I never really believed myself to be a member of the executive branch, life really outside it has just been another challenge to confront, overcome, and brutally destroy. And frankly, without the constant need to interpose into and short-circuit a troublesome bureaucratic chain of command, I've had time these past few weeks to grow a little bit more contemplative and see the bigger picture. I've been able to understand just how completely I was intercoursed over by my former constituent in chief. And I've had the free time to commandeer space on a commercial jet to fly down to Texas to engage him in a useful exchange of views. Thursday, 2:17 p.m.
Well, God knows we're trying to sell it. It's a tough marketplace for a ranch that really needs, you know, some work to make it, an actual ranch.
Mm-hmm. It's a fixer-downer.
Yeah, that's right. And so we're thinking maybe one of the major donors to the library gets the use of the ranch once a month or something. We get that to write that off as a contribution to the library. Everybody's happy till the historians start re-evaluationing me. Then we can sell this puppy for bucco profit.
Mm-hmm. That's great, Mr. President. And I suppose it's all the sweeter because you don't have to deal with any pangs of conscience about the way you treated one of your assistants.
Oh, you're still on the scooter, Libby Kick. Jeez Louise, Dick, give it a rest. Haven't I, Dr. Pepper?
No, thanks. I'm not a Pepper.
All right. Well, first of all, he was your assistant.
Mm-hmm. He also had the title.
I know he did, and I still don't remember appointing him.
You were very busy that month. I decided to help out. I'm a helping out kind of guy.
Well, whoever appointed him.
I guess that's why I ended up with those aforementioned pangs.
Hey, listen, Changester, I got plenty of pangs. I'm up to here with pangs. I'm still getting letters from mothers of men and women serving in Iraq.
You're not still answering them?
No, I gave them to the intern to deal with, but I got pangs about that.
Look, George.
I'm still Mr. President.
Yeah, to those who believe that fairy tale. Let me put it to you in terms of one syllable.
That was Laura's favorite crystal sculpture of Vicente Fox.
Too bad. Now you've let somebody else down. Now listen here. Scooter Libby was and is a great American. He did only what he was asked, and he was crucified by a runaway media that drank the move-on Kool-Aid. He served you very well, better than you know, and you threw him away like a stripper's corn plasters. I hate to say this to you, Mr. President, but at this particular Last Supper, the role of Judas is being performed by you.
Now, Dick, I said at the time that I respected the jury's verdict on Scooter. I just didn't...
Respect their verdict on his sentence. Yeah, made a lot of sense. Look, this man walked out there into the rain of crap every day just asking himself one question. How can I help expand the role of an executive branch that only one of my bosses is actually even a member of? And for this kind of selfless devotion, his reward is that he's not allowed to practice law ever again. It's a pity most of the stuff here is packed up. I really should break a lot more of it. But...
Well, that was the statue of Ronald Reagan that Vicente Fox gave me. Hey, look, Dick, here's what I don't get. Let's say just for the sake of argumenticity that you're right, that Scooter really was my assistant too, that he was the greatest thing since sliced breadcrumbs. So what? In case you haven't noticed, my friend, I'm not president anymore. I got no pardon power. I got no power. You know, sometimes I wish I did when I see the mess that Carl says this guy Obama's making of our work, but I don't. What do you want me to do?
Don't give me this we don't have power anymore crap. If I really believed that, I'd never have left the secure undisclosed.
Oh, please.
You had to leave. They knew where you were. Look, you know as well as I do, we spent the last 3 months of our presidency burrowing our political people into career positions throughout the government.
Yeah.
9 will get you 10. One of them is in the pardon office of the Justice Department. Or can be. He or she backdates a particular document, slips into the Federal Register, and Scooter's got his good name. Or at least his law license back.
Yeah, and when somebody in the medias sees it in the Federal Register?
Oh, the newspaper guys who used to do that are long since retired or bought out. The media people remaining are too busy worshiping at the shrine of St. Obama to cast a glance backward. We're yesterday's news. Finally. Now we can get something done. You can.
Well, why can't you do it, mister? I'm the real... ex-president.
You stupid little duckhead, for the simple reason that this is the only power the damn Constitution specifically reserves to you personally.
You gotta be kidding. They mention my name?
Good news, sir. You're all packed. Thinking about the conversation on the commercial flight back to Wyoming, one thing was clear. The only mature way to deal with my anger over this pathetic situation would be to keep leaking about it. I can do that. And a partial diary for early February 2009. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
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 And now, ladies and gentlemen, hopscotching among the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Motley Crue rocker Nikki Sixx has apologized for reducing a female fan to tears at the band's recent concert in Los Angeles, admitting that the bottle the fan threw back at him was the very same one he threw to the audience. Dateline Tokyo, Japanese Finance Minister Shoichi Nakagawa said this week he will resign from his post. I'd like to submit my resignation. He apologized for his poor behavior at the Group of Seven news conference last week in Rome. Video of the conference showed that Nakagawa at one point mistakenly took a reporter's question about interest rates meant for somebody else. A number of media reports speculated he was under the influence of alcohol, but his cabinet secretary said the behavior was caused by taking too much cold medicine, adding it wouldn't be true if we said he didn't drink any alcohol. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has apologized for past offenses where he dismissively rejected both political parties in New York because he wants to run for office again. Celebrity apologies. Charles Barkley called his drunken driving arrest unacceptable as he prepares to return to his television job as an NBA analyst. This is just my bad, no excuses. I think a DUI is unacceptable. That can't happen, and I've got to challenge other people, not just celebrities or jocks. If people tell him to stop drinking, then I'll have to stop drinking, he said. He apologized to his family, employer, and the NBA, saying he had embarrassed them. He vowed he would start using a driver when he goes out in public. Singer and songwriter Chris Brown apologized for his altercation with his pop star girlfriend Rihanna. He said he is troubled and is seeking counseling, but refused to say exactly what transpired between him and Rihanna due to pending legal issues. The New York Post has apologized for its cartoon of a chimpanzee dead with a caption, "They'll have to find someone else to write the next stimulus bill." To those who are offended by the image, says the Post, we apologize. And finally, in Hull, England, a blind man has refused to accept an apology from a company that sent him a letter addressed to Mr. Blindman. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now back to our conversation with David Wagoner.
David, these designs that you guys did, they were really quite revealing in terms of, I thought two things were going on there. One, as opposed to, and you can tell me if I'm stepping on toes here, but as opposed to what happened right after the flood, when a bunch of, it seemed to me like the city planning profession looked at New Orleans hungrily and the thought bubble above their head read, "Ooh, clean slate," which I found a little off-putting. The approach in this session that you had spoke of people who came in with great respect for the existing culture, the existing grid of the city, the existing way people did things, and was trying to enhance that as opposed to, here's my great new way of having a city, why don't you just follow me, which seemed much more sensitive to the fact that New Orleans has already been here for 300 years and a lot of people kind of like a lot of what the ways the city operates, you know?
Yeah, we like parts of it.
Yeah.
I think that that goes to the Dutch tradition again. They renovate their country. You know, they don't throw it away. I mean, they may develop some low-lying polder and all at once develop that. But generally, it's an incremental renovation. And I think that's what we're ready to do in New Orleans. I hope that's what we're ready to do, which does require some resettlement. It does require some moving around. And we certainly don't have, at a national level, the policies that allow us to do that. You know, if you remember all the way back, Harry, to the Baker bill, I wonder if he'd still be in Congress if that hadn't been cut, because that was a good bill. It was a Republican bill that said there would be some authority set up to allow the logical relocation and fair compensation for people.
And it was attacked by the White House.
It was killed by the White House, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we don't know why, but maybe we could assume they don't have any money. I mean, it seems to be the condition. The theory, the words spoken were that the market had to do it. You know, government didn't belong in that business.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're caught in New Orleans with every issue, aren't we? I mean, you know, now we have to talk about we have to debate these bigger issues. And we don't just get to deal with our own geological, morphological problem. We have to deal with sea level rise.
Yeah.
You know, we're not in a static condition. What we have to do is start moving ourselves. We can't be the victim. We can't be the supplicant forever. So we have to have our own vision of what we'd like to be. And I think that's what you're speaking of, Harry, that New Orleans is an attractive place. How do we make it more attractive? How do we make it safer? And then again, how do we make it a lot fresher? The Dutch, you know, most people who know the Netherlands know Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And the part of Amsterdam that we know the best are the canal rings that, you know, come off the central station and ring that city. Those were built in the 17th century. So 3-4 centuries ago, they were already 300, 400, 500 years into this process. New Orleans is 300 years old in another 9 or so years. So it's a question of how you evolve. And do we think we can, you know, we can morph into something different? And, you know, this advocacy is for, okay, we can, which is the first thing, to get up in the morning and say you can. And then the next thing is to say, well, to what? And I'm, you know, fairly clear in my mind, at least, to invite this other element, this other matter, water, back in instead of excluding it. When we had the first workshop, official one, Dutch Dialogue 1 in March, the theme there that the Dutch, you know, came up with was, where's the water? You could play a child's game with it in New Orleans. Where is it? Because it's nowhere. It's excluded completely. You can visit the water if you go to the lake, or you can visit the water if you go to the river. You can go see Bayou St. John. But you don't see it very often. You see it if you fly in here, if you drive in here. But once you get here, it's fairly much excluded. And what you're doing is excluding not only an asset, but also sort of your, maybe this is a little bit vague, but you know, the element of dreams. You know, New Orleans is the land of dreams, right? But what's the element of dreams? It's water. And we're keeping it out. So we're keeping our own identity away. We're pushing it. You know, we're not letting ourselves be who we are.
Now, you mentioned Bayou St. John, which is maybe the only original waterway, even in its truncated form, left in the city of New Orleans. And yet I read just the other day that the Corps of Engineers was having a meeting with people about whether that was to be denied its source of water in the future or not. So it seems to me that the idea of bringing water into the city is still something that's way in the distance in terms of the way the Corps is thinking. The Corps is now thinking, it looks from my standpoint, like keep all water out at all costs, because water came in last time, bad for us, so keep all water out all the time, whatever. Is that a correct perception of what's going on now?
I think the Corps would say that's their charge. You know, that's the problem definition you've given me, and by golly, I'm going to do what I got to do on time and on budget, you know? And wait a minute, that's a bad idea. It's not economical. It's not efficient. And it's certainly not going to have any ecological health involved in it. I would tell you, though, Harry, I got an email this morning from some neighborhood leader saying that he had 19 groups that wanted me to come and give a few minutes talk about this, and that's all around that Bayou St. John issue. The people here are organized if ineffectual, and I think we're trying hard, but we need a break. We need, and you know, maybe we have to make our own. And again, you know, your help in doing that is good, because clearly we can't just go piece by piece making a problem. I mean, I don't fully understand. You've talked to John Barry on your show before. Mm-hmm. He can tell you more about what happened with the river and how that functions. But you know, this is a continental issue. I mean, I've said that before. This is beyond the scale of New Orleans. We have a giant dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. We have sediment that we can't use. I mean, this river that comes through here drains half the United States. And we start from there, and the Corps of Engineers has been managing and controlling that river according to their charge. And they continue that. But when you come into the scale of the city, it becomes even more delicate, because people live right next to it. You know, neighborhood groups in New Orleans are organized to discuss, if not oppose, what the Corps thinks they want to build for pumps at these barriers at the outfall canals. But we're too small, individuals, neighborhood groups matching against the Corps of Engineers. Maybe we win one, but we don't have a very well-organized condition. You would think that an expert group that is international would get some attention. And the good thing about having had as long as we've had to organize this group is that we're fairly well attached to one another. We can actually function. And, you know, the Dutch have their competing interests, but they fairly much know who applies to who can solve that problem and who's the appropriate party to answer to that. It's just that as a charity routine, it's very hard to sustain that.
Mm-hmm. David, when you talk to people outside the city and they say, "Hey, man, it's global warming. Give it up. Move it inland. It's, you know, you're never going to get the money to, you know, the cost of fighting the rise in sea level. Blah blah. You know that routine. What do you say?"
Well, I sigh, huh? And think, you know, it was hard enough without that. I think New Orleans is protectable in any of these cases. New Orleans can be levied, and you can live down in this bowl as long as the edge of the bowl doesn't break. You can pump the water that comes over in a storm out. Schiphol Airport in the Netherlands is 18, 19 feet below sea level. They're developing areas near Rotterdam that are 20-plus below sea level. And, you know, the Dutch have decided that they'll reinvest, I think, $1.5 billion a year. And I think those are euros, which means $2 billion a year for the next 50 years in improving their flood protection systems. Well, that's a huge national priority. And we don't have that national priority in America, obviously. We just want to people say, "Why don't you guys just move up to Baton Rouge or maybe to Shreveport?" You know, but this is an attractive place to live. It is the bottom of the river, and if there was anything that those of us who were alive in the 60s bemoan, I think it's the lack of this ability that we can do anything in the country. You know, because in the 60s we had all this maybe naive but sometimes proven optimism. We're going to go to the moon, and we did it, you know. Here we can't even sustain a good part of a state.
I think one of the things that we're seeing in the post-Katrina environment is people in New Orleans just saying, "Well, nobody else is going to do it, so damn it, I will." And you seem to be in the vanguard of that particular parade. So thank you for doing that.
Well, I appreciate it. I mean, you know, it's interesting, though. I mean, let's look at what New Orleans also represents. It does represent, the city represents the vanguard of, you know, survival thinking. It also calls for new ways of thinking. I mean, I had noticed over the last 5 years, Harry, that planners began to think and talk more and more about the word flows. At a point, they talked about nodes. I don't know if you remember all that, but this is, you know, the way it was talked about. Well, everything in South Louisiana is a flow. All this water thing is a flow system, and it's really the current way to think about engineering, the current way to think about planning. So, you know, part of that, you know, the famous, I don't know if it was really a Japanese curse, but, you know, may you live in interesting times.
Chinese curse, you know, yes.
Chinese, well, yeah. then may we live in an interesting place, you know? Mm-hmm. We live in an interesting place. And it's worth it. If this had happened to many other places, I don't think we would find the Dutch government saying, no, this matters. You can protect this. And I believe we can protect it, Harry. I mean, if I give up, then I won't move to Shreveport. I came from there, but I'll go somewhere, you know? But I can't do that. It would be a defeatism of the worst sort. But we have to say we have a smarter way to do it. We can't just continue as the sort of dumb, clueless ones who need some help. We have to help ourselves, huh?
Hmm. Well, it would be interesting, you know, that the Dutch, as you know, your history of New Orleans, the Dutch came over in 1953 after their huge, disastrous floods and took a look at the pump that had been originated by a New Orleanian, Mr. Wood, and that started them on their latest round of technological innovation to protect themselves. It'd be nice if sometime in the future the tables are turned again and the Dutch come to New Orleans to learn how to do stuff.
Well, you know, it's an industry too, Harry. We very much need to become a smarter place, and we need to have new things we do. And obviously we could become part of a national, if not worldwide, community that knew a lot about water and that people who had something to learn came here to find people who knew how to do it. Maybe there's good karma. It's just in decades and not years that it occurs. The Dutch ambassador went to Mary Landrieu and I believe also to the White House right after Katrina and said, don't talk about wiping this out. We can help. This is fixable. So, you know, they know they're not debt, but they know that we had some help. We helped them before, or that our technology helped them before. I think we have to be careful not to think only in terms of technology, though. Not all these systems are high technology. Some of them are more natural than
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the groundwater situation in South Louisiana especially, but in New Orleans even more especially, has to be managed. We can't just throw the water away. It's an asset, you know, to keep our wet soil from shrinking. So, you know, we can't just rely on pumps and pipes. We have to do some landscape things. This is really a gentle way to think about it. But, you know, water encourages that, even if it is sometimes fearful.
Well, David, thank you for keeping the flow going, and thanks for all you're doing for the city, and thanks for coming in today to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
To see in graphic form the ideas that we've been discussing in terms of the Dutch Dialogues, go to dutchdialogues.com. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world, facilities in the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on your computer whenever you want it at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. Available as a free download for members at www.audible.com/LeShow. And it'd be just like reimagining our relationship with water if you'd agree to be with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music featured hereon are always available at harryshearer.com. A tip of the LeShow chapeau to the San Diego, Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Hawaii desks, and to Jenny Lawson at WWNO and Jeffrey Talbot at AudioWorks for engineering help on today's broadcast. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. See you on the streets. So long from the Mardi Gras world of New Orleans.